Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
It is July 4th, Independence Day here in the United States of America. In addition to backyard cookouts, parades, and fireworks, our attention as a nation turns historically to the era of our founding. Not surprisingly, we give a great deal of our attention to the Declaration of Independence. But this early July holiday also offers us the opportunity to reflect upon many other documents associated with our nation's beginning, including the Articles of Confederation, the U.S. Constitution, and the Bill of Rights, which is the first 10 amendments to our U.S. Constitution, of course. Last week on the show, we tackled the debate over whether the U.S. was founded as a Christian nation. We continue examining that topic today with another scholar who specializes in that area, Professor Mark David Hall of George Fox University in Newburgh, Oregon. Mark is the Herbert Hoover Distinguished Professor of Political Science at George Fox and is the author of numerous books, including, but not limited to, The Founders on God and Government, America's Forgotten Founders, which is a revised edition that's coming out this coming year, The Forgotten Founders on Religion and Public Life, and The Sacred Rights of Conscience, Selected Readings on Religious Liberty and Church-State Relations in the American Founding. Professor Hall just finished writing another manuscript on one of our nation's most overlooked founding fathers, Roger Sherman, who will be the topic of today's discussion. And for those of you with a good memory or who have ransacked our archives recently, you will recognize Mark as one of our very first guests on this podcast series, talking about the wall of separation debate in U.S. legal history. Indeed, I think Mark has written perhaps one of the best articles on the wall of separation and how it has affected U.S. Supreme Court cases over time. Now, we'll link to that article as well as to all his books and his earlier podcast on our website, so please do check that out. Mark, welcome back to Research on Religion. We missed you.
Hi, Tony. Thanks for having me back.
All right, so I understand you just returned from a trip to China. How did that go?
Well, it's close. I'm leaving for it tomorrow.
Oh, yes, you're leaving. That reminds me to tell our listeners that we are actually not broadcasting live, but we record these podcasts usually in advance, and we're recording this one in early June. So just in case Roger Sherman or George Washington or Ben Franklin rise from the grave and start to tell us what their original intent was, we won't hold you responsible for reading their minds or anything like that if they do rise from the grave. Is that okay?
That's great.
All right. Well, actually, where are you going over to China for? It seems like you're a guy who specializes in the American founding. So why heading over to China?
Well, I do specialize in the American founding, but it's going to be a great time. I'm going over with 10 American scholars, and we're going to meet up with 10 Chinese scholars and talk about religious liberty in China.
Wow, that's neat.
So it should be real fun.
I think we're going to have to connect up with you on that because I'd like to see what comes of that. We just had a podcast recently, too, on China and house churches, so it'd be a good follow-up to see somebody who specializes in American politics going over to China and reflecting through that lens. So that'd be great.
Sure, I'd be happy to do that.
Okay, so last week, we jumped into the controversial debate of whether or not America was founded as a Christian nation, a debate that's not only historical, but I think one that plays to how we envision the role of church and state in contemporary society. And I'm really happy to be following up with you on that discussion from last week because I had the chance to read through your latest book manuscript, and your work really puts a spotlight on one of the lesser known but critically important founders of our nation, and that is Roger Sherman. And again, most of our attention usually gets drawn to Jefferson or Madison or Washington, but really there was a lot of other people at play during the founding, and Roger Sherman, you make a very strong case, is one of them. And I should note, too, that your book manuscript is more than just a political biography in that it uses Sherman to illustrate a strain of political thought derived principally from Calvinist theology, that was really present in intellectual circles in the late 18th century. And this is a brilliant scholarly device because it really brings to life what would otherwise be this highly abstract, philosophical, perhaps theological discussion. So let's anchor this discussion in terms of Roger Sherman and start out by telling us the background of this guy. Who's Roger Sherman?
Okay, sure. Well, he was born in 1721 in Massachusetts, moved as a young man to Connecticut. He came from a lower middle class background, so he was a farmer and a cobbler originally. Taught himself mathematics and started producing almanacs, kind of like Ben Franklin. And then eventually got into surveying and he became an attorney. He apprenticed under another attorney and became an attorney. And then his career really took off. He was elected to the lower house of the Connecticut General Assembly and then very soon after that to the upper house. Back then in Connecticut and in most of the colonies, they didn't really understand the separation of powers as we do. So when he was in the upper house, he was also on the Connecticut Superior Court, which is basically their Supreme Court, and eventually got elected mayor of the town of New Haven. So he's holding all these offices simultaneously. And then, as we approached the War for Independence, he was appointed to the Continental and Confederation Congresses. And so he's holding all these multiple offices simultaneously and did a lot of interesting stuff in Connecticut. We might have a chance to talk about that, but to focus at the national level, he was in the Continental Congress when the Congress drafted the Declaration of Independence, and in fact, he was on the five-person committee that put that document together.
Yeah, that's really important to note because I think most people think that the Declaration of Independence was just a Jefferson thing.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right, and in fact, Jefferson did do the primary draft, but there's an interesting reason for that, Tony. Jefferson was on one major committee at that time. Roger Sherman was on three major committees. He was on the committee tasked with drafting the Declaration of Independence. He was also on the committee tasked with drafting the Articles of Confederation. And he was on the Board of War, which was probably the most important committee in the middle of the war. Whereas Thomas Jefferson, the young Thomas Jefferson, was just on one committee. And so he had more time in which to draft the Declaration of Independence. And of course, he did come up with the initial rough draft, but then the Committee of Five went over the draft and changed it, and then the text went to the entire Congress, which of course changed it further. So Thomas Jefferson certainly gets a lot of credit for the Declaration of Independence, but I think we do have to understand that it was a product of a community, a much broader community than just Jefferson. Well, so anyway, he was heavily involved in the War for Independence, involved in the Continental and Confederation Congress under the Articles of Confederation, which I mentioned he helped draft. I believe he served in the Continental and Confederation Congresses more days than all but four men. So only four men served in this original National Congress, more than him. He was in Philadelphia when the Constitution was drafted, and a number of scholars have said that he's second in importance only to James Madison. Played a critical role in helping to frame that document. He was then elected to the first Congress, where he was intimately involved in framing the Bill of Rights, and then moved up to the Senate and died in about 1793 or so. That's just a brief overview of his career, and we can go back to specific points if you'd like.
Yeah, actually, one of the other things that you bring to life in the story of Roger Sherman, and again, right now this is in manuscript form. I know you're shopping it around, and I hope to see it in print very soon, and we'll make sure our listeners know when it comes out. But you talk about Sherman's early life, and well, first of all, you mentioned he was a cobbler, and I think by that you don't mean he was a tasty apple pie treat, but he was a guy who worked on shoes, right?
Exactly right.
Okay, just checking, because you know, July 4th here, I'm thinking apple pie, cobblers, and the like. That tells us that this guy was a business person. This was a person who had his hands in all aspects of life. The other thing that really amazed me about him was that between his two wives, he had 15 kids.
It is amazing, isn't it?
When did he have time to do any of this? I guess he wasn't playing Xbox or anything, but
no, I think that's right. And I have to say, try to be objective, the one thing I'd probably done Roger Sherman on is being a good dad. I think he was just away serving his country so much that he didn't have a lot of time for his kids. And a number of the kids from the first marriage ended up having fairly troubled paths. From the second marriage, though, his first wife died. I think the mom probably did a better job and raised just a great flock of kids. And if people have heard the name Roger Sherman, they might have heard it because of his grandson, Roger Sherman Baldwin, who famously argued the side of the slaves in the Amistad case. So that was Roger Sherman's grandson who did that.
Yeah. Well, that's a good lesson. For all those of you thinking about founding a country, don't forget to pay attention to your kids, lest they grow up to be lawyers.
Right.
Let's talk about what we know about Roger Sherman. If I went around and asked people on the street at a parade, and who I would say are fairly knowledgeable of U.S. history, or even some of my scholarly colleagues, to name the founders of the United States, they would easily come up with Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, George Washington, John Adams, and Ben Franklin. But I'm pretty much going to guess that few people would mention Roger Sherman. We really haven't heard much of Roger Sherman. Why is that?
Well, you know, that's a great question. Some of it's just almost random type things. One thing is that he was relatively old. You think about the people we know from the American founding, all of them went on to play very prominent roles in the New Republic, right? Of the five people you listed, four became presidents. Sherman died very early in our nation's history, so he just never had the time to play that sort of prominent role. As well, they were all presidents. I think being president sort of shines a spotlight on you. And you could be a very important representative or senator and perhaps not be well remembered by American history. A couple other sort of quirky type things. The ones you mentioned, including Ben Franklin, who died pretty early in our nation's history as well, these guys saved their papers. The papers of George Washington are going to be about 100 volumes. The papers of the Adams family, another 100. The papers of James Madison, probably 50 or so volumes. Even Alexander Hamilton, who died at a very early age, his papers are about 32 volumes. Someone like Roger Sherman just simply didn't save his papers. He wasn't looking to preserve his place in history, so scholars just had a lot less with which to work. Another possibility, and I hesitate to say this because I don't want it to sound conspiratorial, but I think sometimes scholars, when they're looking at the American founding, they might have, even in the back of their minds, a scholarly agenda or a political agenda, a contemporary agenda. And so they might look for some of the more enlightened founders more likely to support the separation of church and state. And so someone like a Madison or Jefferson really are very attractive to them. Whereas Roger Sherman, he's an old Puritan. He doesn't have a problem with established churches. He doesn't have a problem with legislation that supports a Christian Sabbath or that punishes vice or that sort of thing. So I think they tend to look at him and say, gosh, this guy's just not interesting. We certainly don't want people to get the notion that the American founders were like that guy. We want them to think of the founders as a Jefferson or a Madison, a Hamilton or a Franklin, something like that.
And when you talk about the other founders, the Hamiltons, the Jeffersons, being of the enlightened variety, you're not using it with a small e at the beginning, but the big E, meaning the English or Scottish Enlightenment, which is something we're going to come back to, because one would, after reading your manuscript, I think one would have a hard time saying that Sherman was unenlightened. I mean, he was very well educated in a very different way. And as you mentioned, it's not in what we would consider secular Enlightenment readings. And again, we're going to come back to that. So I urge our listeners to pay close attention to this discussion, because you make a very interesting argument about this. But he wasn't necessarily steeped in the Enlightenment per se, but more he was enlightened in Calvinist theology. And in your book, you quote actually John Adams, who might fall into that category of being one of these enlightened founders. John Adams described him as an old Puritan, as honest as an angel, and as firm in the cause of American independence as Mount Atlas, which really indicates that he was a patriot, first and foremost. And John Adams is really saying that right there. But I'm kind of curious about what he meant by old Puritan. And this, I guess, gets us to Sherman's religious beliefs. So what made Sherman an old Puritan?
Sure. Well, of course, there really aren't Puritans in this era. So he's using it, and I use the phrase Puritan in reference to Sherman in a literary sort of way. Basically, it refers to followers, loosely, of John Calvin, one of the great reformers. And Calvin, of course, wrote his great Institutes of the Christian Religion, and generally is representative of Reformed theology, or the Reformed political tradition, which began with Calvin, but then very quickly developed. And so it's a mistake to think that Calvin represents all of Calvinism or all of Reformed theology or Reformed politics. You have people like John Knox and Goodman and others that we need to consider as we talk about Sherman. But Sherman was a thoroughgoing Calvinist. He was a member of a Congregational Church. He was one of the elders in New England. You didn't become a church leader by virtue of your status. Down in Virginia, you did. If you were of the gentry, if you were a Jefferson or Washington, you're virtually automatically vestryman. In New England, you had to, first of all, you had to prove that you had a conversion experience in order to join the church. And that's one reason sometimes people get confused and think that church membership was low in the late 18th century, because it's actually very difficult to join a church. You might regularly attend a church, be a thoroughgoing Christian by almost any measure, but if you don't stand before the church and are able to articulate this profound conversion experience, you wouldn't be allowed to join it. So he had joined it. He was an elder. He actually went to a church that was pastored by Jonathan Edwards Jr., the son of the great theologian. And he was just steeped in the tradition. He wrote theological letters. He engaged in theological debates. He refused to travel on the Sabbath. He was just a thoroughgoing Reformed Christian or Calvinist.
So this is something, he didn't take religion lightly in any way, shape, or form at all. Now, tell us a little bit about the context of the Reformed movement at the time of independence, say roughly the 1770s. I guess this puts us into the context of Washington and Jefferson and Madison and those folks, that Puritanism seemed to be waning a little bit, or there was a divide between old light Puritans and new light Puritans. Where did Sherman fall in this tradition?
Sure. Just by way of deep background, of course, New England was formed by Puritans, right? Those followers of John Calvin who weren't satisfied with the way in which the Church of England was being purified. And so they fled first to Holland and then to Plymouth Rock. And then you have this great wave of Puritan migration in the 17th century. And so New England was just thoroughly Calvinist. There is this impression that had kind of died down. But from my poking at it and looking at it, you find, in fact, that the Reformed tradition is still very prevalent throughout America, certainly in New England. Absolutely and utterly dominant in New England. Now, you do have the Great Awakening in the early 18th century, and basically what you had there was a different kind of Protestant Christianity, represented well by John Whitfield, who went around and held revival meetings, was far more emotional than Reformed Congregationalists and Presbyterians tended to be. So there is more of an emphasis on using techniques to try to bring people to the point of a conversion experience. One thing that's kind of interesting, you might think that a new light, that sounds progressive, right? Whereas the old light sound conservative. But actually, the new lights wanted a more rigorous Christianity. They, for instance, said that only those people who have joined a church should be able to have communion, whereas the old lights were much more open, and they were willing to have people who maybe would identify themselves as Christians but hadn't formally joined a church. They were willing to let them have communion or take the Eucharist. And so the new lights are really more conservative by almost any measure. And Sherman was one of these new lights. He joined a new light church and was active in the movement. When the new lights took over Yale College, he was actually appointed treasurer of Yale College and was heavily involved in that bastion of Reformed thinking there.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a really important point to make about the Great Awakening and also the New Lights, because what we see throughout religious history is these ebbs and flows of religious denominations. They start off very fervent in their behavior and they have very strict standards, and they tend to loosen up over time. And especially within Protestantism, that usually tends to give rise to a new type of movement that wants to get back to the basics, to bring back the strictness to the religion, get back to the gospel, etc. And the new lights are part of this movement. And we're seeing this around the middle part of the 18th century, and the Great Awakening is. So America, circa the 1740s, 1750s, 1760s, all leading up to the Revolution, is really getting another big, huge dose of religiosity, right?
Yeah, I think that's an accurate way to describe it. A more religious emotion, I think, is probably a good way to to think about it, more of a renewed commitment to spreading the gospel. You see, you'd have these revivalist preachers that would go around the country holding revival meetings. Really, this is the origins of evangelicalism within America. And one thing, you know, we oftentimes think of evangelicals as backwater types, as conservatives. But one thing they've always been good at is being innovative and sharing the gospel. So these guys used new techniques. They really integrated the media well, newspapers in this era. Later, of course, in the 19th century, with the Second Great Awakening, they used the penny press and pamphlets and tent revivals. In the 20th century, evangelicals were the first on the radio waves, on television, on internet, and that sort of thing. So, yeah, the First Great Awakening is represented well by the sort of innovation in serious commitment to the gospel and to living in the Christian manner.
And that's really important for the argument that we're trying to make here when it comes to the founding and the writing of our foundational documents here, because it's been widely argued recently that the famous five founders, I guess that would be Jefferson, Madison, Franklin, Washington, and Adams, really tended toward a more liberal form of Christianity, often called deism or Unitarianism more specifically. John Adams probably a little bit less so than others, but it would seem that the major figures of the time that we refer to in all our high school textbooks were not as orthodox in their Christian beliefs as Sherman was. So here's my question about that. Was the theology of Jefferson and Madison the dominant religious position in the Continental Congress, or was Sherman more representative of the men who were involved in the drafting of the Articles of Confederation and the Constitution?
Well, I think absolutely Roger Sherman. And let me tell you why. I want you to think for a minute about the five folks you mentioned. Of the five, three of them, Washington, Jefferson, and Madison, were elite Southern Anglicans, right? They were plantation owners. Alexander Hamilton, you didn't mention Hamilton, but he's kind of an interesting case. He was born down in Jamaica. Thomas Paine, who's often mentioned as well, was born and raised in England, and he only lived 20 of his 77 years in America, so I think you can reasonably say he hardly counts as an American. He came from a Quaker background, and his adults, both Hamilton and Franklin, were nominal Anglicans. In an era where very few people traveled internationally, Jefferson and Adams both spent significant time in Europe, and Ben Franklin lived most of the last 35 years of his life in Britain and France. So think about the sample that we're looking at. And I expanded your sample by two.
Yeah, it didn't sound good to say famous seven because I like the alliteration of famous five.
Yeah, no, that does work better. But so of this famous seven, only one of these people, John Adams, is a member of a Reformed Church. And he is, it's accurate to say, is moving toward Unitarianism. By way of contrast, the great students of American religious history, people like Sidney Alston and Harry Stout, who's still active at Yale, have said that around 1776, about three out of four colonists were connected with Reformed denominations, or Calvinist denominations. Now, those figures might be a little high, but if they're high, it's still well over a majority. And yet, this majority of Americans are barely represented in this elite seven or elite five. And the one representative they have, John Adams, is one of the few Reformed types who is moving in a direction of Unitarianism. Let me just give you a quick list of folks, some of which I'm sure most of our listeners will recognize, some of which they won't. But in addition to Roger Sherman, you have people like Samuel Adams. We all know Samuel Adams, right, from the beer, but also critical.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if the clock had stopped in 1780, Samuel Adams would definitely be among the elite Americans that we look to as a critical revolutionary. Elias Boudinot, Eliphas Dyer, Oliver Ellsworth, a critical participant in the First Congress and the Constitutional Convention, author of the Judiciary Act of 1791, Matthew Griswold, John Hancock, famous John Hancock of the Declaration of Independence, Benjamin Huntington, Samuel Huntington, William Patterson, the New Jersey Plan, Tapping Reed, Jesse Root, John Treadwell, Jonathan Trimble, William Williams, James Wilson, the great Scott and Presbyterian, John Witherspoon, the president of Princeton, Oliver Wolcott. So all these folks are Reformed founders, many of whom played critical roles in the American founding. And I would say I have no reason to doubt all of them are Orthodox Christians. Most of them are good Calvinists. And these folks are completely neglected because we focus so much on these bright, shining lights. And, of course, they are shining lights. And Jefferson's just absolutely brilliant. He's fun to read and fun to study. But he's just not representative of the American founders, much less the broader group of Americans in the late 18th century.
That's a really good point. We do tend to see this skewed sample, and we think, well, if we put Adams in the John Adams, that is, in the Reformed camp, I mean, that's one out of seven. I was calling the Super Seven. And so we would tend to think that, yeah, there's less than 20% of the population is really influenced by this reform movement. But you do make a really good case. You know, much of the population was there in the northern colonies, and this is where, you know, the Calvinism was much stronger, and not surprisingly, they had much more representation at that time.
You do have, incidentally, the number of Calvinists in the middle Atlantic colonies and south is increasing dramatically in this era because you have all these Scotch-Irish moving over.
Well, that's true, yeah.
So even though you might have the Anglican Church being established in Virginia, you have all these Presbyterians down in western Virginia, and their agitation is one of the reasons the church there is eventually disestablished.
Well, let's talk about this Calvinist theology and actually bring it to the issue of political theology or political philosophy, because, again, one of the things you do really well in your book is to ground the debate, the intellectual debate at the time, not just among Enlightenment folks, but also among these Calvin, and really root it in the form of Roger Sherman here, John Witherspoon, you mentioned, and a few other folks as well in there. So in the debate regarding whether or not the U.S. was founded as a Christian nation, you know, a lot of scholars often portray the likes of Jefferson and Madison as being influenced by the more secular elements of the Enlightenment in its various guises of being the English Enlightenment, Scottish Enlightenment, the Continental Enlightenment, and, you know, folks like John Locke and David Hume as being the intellectual bright lights of the time there. And in some ways, this emphasis on secular philosophy gives the image that the Enlightenment thought was really a polar opposite to religious thought at that time, but that really wasn't necessarily the case. When it comes to the thinking of the time, as you argue, Calvinist thinking really reached many of the same conclusions about governance and religious liberty that the quote-unquote secular enlightened folks did at that time. So could you explain that a little bit?
Sure. Well, let's talk about Calvinism in a minute. Let me highlight one of the things you're saying, though, is there are different forms of the Enlightenment. Oftentimes we think of the radical enlightenment of the continent, people like Voltaire. That's actually very rare in the American context. Far more influential here was the Scottish enlightenment, which in many ways was compatible with Christianity. I think we can look at John Witherspoon, the president of Princeton, who himself was a Scotchman, James Wolfson, who came from Scotland, as folks who were both serious Christians and heavily influenced by the Scottish enlightenment. So there's, you know, maybe more compatibility there. John Locke as well is usually viewed as a product of the Enlightenment, although in many respects his father was a Puritan, and you can see Locke as, certainly you can see his political views as a logical extension of reform reflection upon politics. So if we focus down on Calvinism, just real broadly, real briefly, of course, Calvinists are a critically important part of the Protestant Reformation, which occurred in the 16th century. Basically, Christians who believed that the Roman Catholic Church had become corrupt in certain ways. And some of the great battle cries of the Reformation, which the Calvinists certainly shared in, were things like sola fide, sola scriptura.
Scripture alone.
Mm-hmm. Sola fide is faith alone. Mm-hmm. We are saved by faith alone. We don't have to buy indulgences from the Catholic Church. We don't have to do good deeds in order to earn salvation. Sola scriptura. We're going to rely on the Word of God for our information, for knowledge about God. We aren't going to defer to the magisterium of the church. I think critical with respect to politics is the priesthood of all believers. As you know, Roman Catholicism, certainly at that time, was very sacerdotal. That is, there's a layer of priests that basically stand between the layperson and God, and you go to the priest to confess your sins. You go to the priest for moral and theological advice. The Catholic Church at that time would say lay people shouldn't even read the Bible, right? That's for the priest to do. We can't let the lay person read the Bible. The reformers said, no, every person needs to be able to read the Bible and decide for himself or herself what is truth. And that's not relativistic. There's no sense that whatever you come to is the truth, but you as an individual have the responsibility to dive into the Word of God and figure out what is true and what is not true. Now, you think about some of the implications of this, and some of this is just very practical. It's not even high theory. if you truly believe that everyone needs to be able to read the Word of God, what are some things that follow from that? Well, one thing is that everyone needs to be able to read. And so one thing you saw within countries that embraced Protestantism is you saw literacy rates of a sort that the world had never seen. Very rapidly, within a couple of generations, these Protestant countries had close to universal male literacy. You need the Word of God readily available. So you had Gutenberg come up with this printing press, and Bibles are just everywhere. In New England, in fact, Connecticut certainly had a law requiring every household to have a Bible, every household to have catechisms. If poor people can't afford these sorts of things, they'll be provided to them by the community. Well, as you know, Tony, democratic theorists will say one of the prerequisites of democracy is literacy, or something approximating it. And so within these Protestant countries, you're having a movement toward democracy, I think, at this very basic level, or at least you're having the prerequisites that are being put in place. The priesthood of all believers led, I think, pretty rapidly to democratic forms of church governance. The most obvious example of this is the congregationalist form of church government, where the congregation gets together and decides who will be the next pastor, and they vote on whether or not to raise money for a building, this sort of thing. Well, this is a training ground for democracy, right? You got people coming together, articulating their positions, and then you have a vote that is taken. And so within these congregational, within these Calvinist churches, they tended to be democratic, and not thoroughly democratic, and of course you have some deference to elites and that sort of thing. We definitely have a move towards democracy. The emphasis on sola fide, I think, pretty rapidly translated to a version of religious liberty. Certainly not the full-throated religious liberty we insist on today, but generally the idea that you don't try to compel people in terms of religion. You can't make someone have faith, right? So it just doesn't have laws requiring people to believe. And so you get a early forms of religious liberty that begin to come in these countries that are then embrace Calvinism. I think here, Switzerland, Holland, England, and then, of course, America.
Let me pause you a minute, because you said something that is interesting and really struck me in reading through your articles as well. You just a minute ago said that, you know, it's based upon this idea, or Calvinist theology is based upon this idea, is you can't force people to take their faith. It's not externally imposed on them, so to speak. But when you take a look at some of the rules, laws, and regulations that you had during the colonial time and, you know, shortly after the war, etc., it tended to seem that there was a great deal of theocracy, I guess. There was influence over the regular lives of individuals. And now I quote from one of your other papers here, and something to the effect, now this was in Pennsylvania, and that's more Quaker at the time, but it really kind of reflected a lot of the laws here, that there were laws including prohibitions on swearing, cursing, lying, profane talking, drunkenness, drinking of healths, I'm not sure what that meant, obscene words, incest, sodomy, stage plays, so theater was looked upon suspiciously, cards, dice, May games, gamesters, masks, revels, bull baiting, cockfighting, bear baiting, and the like, which excite the people to rudeness, cruelty, looseness, and irreligion. So, you know, in terms of this idea of liberty, it didn't seem that they were very libertine in their thinking. What do you have to say about that?
Well, I think it's exactly right. Everyone in this era, and I do mean close to everyone, people of all traditions, Calvinists, and keep in mind the document you just quoted came from nice, tolerant Quaker Pennsylvania, right? In certainly England, all these folks would have distinguished between liberty and license, and the idea that you have that you should have a freedom to do things that are wrong, to have sex with another man's wife or something like that. None of these folks would have thought that this is a liberty that we should have. And so within all of these colonies, within all the states, within all the European countries, I believe, I haven't really studied it in detail, you would have all sorts of laws punishing immoral actions. And it was viewed that the state had an important role to play to protect and encourage Christianity. There's nothing wrong with making things that are immoral illegal. There should be certain sorts of freedom. You should be free to make choices in certain areas, but that doesn't include the freedom to make wrong choices. Interestingly enough, you mentioned theocracy. The Puritans, in some ways, separated church and state more than most other societies. You know, clearly in their mind, and in most Christians' mind, there's an institution known as a church and an institution known as a state, right? Going back to Pope Gelasius and others, we have these two swords, these two institutions that have different purposes. Although oftentimes you have a lot of overlap, but the Puritans avoided that. Just to give you a few examples, at least initially, the Puritan Massachusetts didn't permit clergymen to hold office. So clergy couldn't hold political office, right?
Mm-hmm.
Second of all, they had, for instance, clearly in the Massachusetts Body of Liberties, if you were a civic official and you were excommunicated by the church, and they did practice excommunication, that didn't affect your civil office. You're still a governor or lieutenant governor or whatever else you happen to be. We never had ecclesiastical courts in America like it existed in England and on the continent. Clearly, the church and the state are going to work together. They're partners. A very common phrase is that the state is a nursing father, or the monarch is a nursing father, to protect, to encourage Christianity. But there is really, even in Puritan New England, a sense that you don't compel people in matters of religion, that is, in matters of belief. You can't force people to believe something, so we won't even try to compel them. Now, we might force them not to work on Sabbath. For times, we might force them to actually go to church, but we won't actually try to make them believe anything.
Mm-hmm.
And does that make sense?
Yeah, that does. And I think that's a really interesting part of your book where you differentiate the idea between liberty and personal license. And again, there's a tendency that we have today to view the past through our contemporary culture. And we will tend to think of, well, you know, they're not letting you work on the Sabbath. And, oh my gosh, that's so authoritarianism. That's just like North Korea,
right,
or something like that. But again, as you point out, this was common for the era. And there's a subtlety, as you mentioned, in this distinction between liberty and personal license that, you know, you have the freedom in a lot of other areas, but it cannot carry over to behavior that could be detrimental to the community at large.
Right.
Yeah. Let me talk now a little bit, and let's get back to Roger Sherman a little bit.
Sure.
Well, actually, no, let's, before we do that, I want to step back and because you do make a general point about this Calvinist theology, and you do a really wonderful job of explaining how it is, it's a rebellious, very empowering philosophy for the citizenry. This idea of covenants is really constitution building amongst the citizenry, etc. To what extent did that philosophy seep into the general public, and then also to the intellectuals at the time of the founding? I mean, was there this big separation between the secular Enlightenment folks and the Calvinists, or was there some degree of confluence between the two?
Well, that's a great point. I neglected to mention covenants, the idea that a covenant is much like a contract, except God is a witness and enforcer of the agreement. And so one of the most famous early American covenants is the Mayflower Compact, we call it, where the pilgrims got together and they basically said, okay, we're going to agree to form a civic union for these purposes, first and foremost being to glorify God. That's how they always form their civic communities. That's how they form their churches, people coming together and agreeing to participate in a communal endeavor and swearing to do so before the eyes of God. Within these things, and it's critical to recognize that New England was the most democratic place the world had ever seen. I mentioned before, you know, you have virtual universal mail literacy. You did oftentimes have pretty minor property qualifications in order to become a freeman or in order to vote. But they were so minimal, and of course the country was so wide open that almost anyone could do that, almost any male. You had the traditional New England town meetings, right, where the town would get together and talk about where they should build a road, should they build a new church, or that sort of thing. So you had people coming together, arguing these things out, voting for them. Basically, the crown, you never had a royal government in a place like, a governor in a place like Connecticut. And so the people are electing every civic official, and they're governing themselves, they're taxing themselves. It's thoroughly democratic throughout all of New England. This is largely true in the South as well, but in the South you have much more of an aristocratic sort of government, where you have the plantation owners who are deferred to, and suffrage rates are lower. They're still pretty high from the context of world history and the world at that time, but they're certainly lower than New England. And this is one of the critical things that lead up to the War for Independence, that is, Americans had been governing themselves for 200 or 300 years. They've been making all the decisions, all the taxes they're paying, or virtually all of them, they're voting on. And they're putting together militias to go fight the Indians, to protect themselves. They're passing criminal laws. And it's only after the French and Indian War where Parliament starts trying to get money from Americans, starts trying to lay taxes on the American Stamp Act, the Sugar Act, things like that, that these folks say, hey, wait a minute, you can't do this. This is highly problematic for a number of reasons, constitutional, legal. And I think just critically, it violated, it went against what they had been used to for so many hundred years.
Mm-hmm. And it's really important to really point this out, that we think of that, and a lot of historians nowadays think of that as the Enlightenment influence here. But you make a very good point that Calvinist theology was completely consistent with this. And in fact, there may have been, to a large extent, more Calvinist theology rabble-rousing than Enlightenment rabble-rousing when it came to the time to call people to arms for independence.
I think that's exactly right. One of the things that drives me crazy as a scholar, so many people, when they look at the American founding, they see a reference to natural rights, or the right to resist a bad government, or that government should be based on the consent of the governed. They say right away, aha, John Locke. This is the influence of John Locke. And what is neglected, even by very smart people, is that within Reformed political thought, you had these ideas in spades 100 years before John Locke wrote the Second Treatise of Government. People like Stephanus Junius Brutus, a Goodman, a Poney, a John Knox. These guys were saying, Calvin, I should say, sometimes people look at Calvin and say, oh, he's pretty conservative. What Calvin said is occasionally there might be instances where inferior magistrates need to resist a superior magistrate if he becomes ungodly or unjust. But even as Calvin was still alive, he had people like John Knox saying, no, you know, sometimes the people have to resist an ungodly magistrate. And then very quickly they started talking in terms of an unjust magistrate, a magistrate who would take property that he shouldn't take, that would violate a right to life. And they did talk in terms of rights. And so they're talking in this way, that people have rights, the government should be based on the consent of the governed, that people have a right, the people have a right to resist an ungodly government, more than 100 years before John Locke. And it's these folks, of course, that came over and settled America, particularly New England. New England, keep in mind, is the intellectual center of America. When you look at where books were produced, where the great universities are, Harvard, Yale, Columbia, so forth, it's New England. And oftentimes even Southern aristocrats would be sent up to New England, like James Madison went up to Princeton in order to receive an education. And so this is where I think a lot of this ideology that we attribute to John Locke comes from. Locke, as you might have read in my book, we think he was a lot more influential than he actually was. Locke wasn't really even in America. His works weren't in America until the 1720s or so. And even there, for the next 50 years, most of what a few Americans talked about was his essay on human understanding. It's only around the time of the 1770s that people start quoting and using his Second Treatise of Government. And even there, I think that these Americans just see him as a natural ally, as someone who's articulating well these ideas that others have articulated and that they grew up with as the Reformed and Calvinists. The Calvinists, incidentally, I looked really, really hard to find a Calvinist minister who supported the British. I eventually found a couple, but they're overwhelmingly on the side of the Patriots because they're so sensitive to tyrannical government that they reacted far more powerfully against the movements of the Crown and Parliament than did, say, the Anglican ministers that were more or less split 50-50.
Yeah, one of the things that I found completely convincing in your work was that when you think about rabble-rousing for the cause of independence, people weren't picking up books of John Locke and saying, here, read the treatise on toleration. They were picking up the Bible, and they were really calling back to their Calvinistic roots. And it's not just the ministers who were there, but, well, you know, some of the ministers were part of the Continental Congress. I mean, these were guys, and you went through that list earlier, that were all influenced by Reformed theology. And so they, yeah, Locke was a great ally in this war, but when it came time to really mobilize people, you know, they reached in their back pocket for what they really, really knew, and that's Calvinist theology.
I think it's funny, the British recognize this. I think King George actually called the American Rebellion the Presbyterian Rebellion, right? And I give a nice series of quotes where the loyalists of one stripe or British generals are blaming the black regiment, the dissenting clergy, as the cause of the war for independence. It truly was amazing. It was an almost universal support among Reformed Americans for the war for independence, where, as I said before, this isn't true for all denominations, and the Anglican being a good example of that. Now, it is true that people like George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison were Anglicans and certainly great patriots, but I think they probably had some other things going on there.
Yeah, let's, with the time that we have remaining here, I want to talk specifically about what Roger Sherman did, what role he played in the foundational documents that we had. Tell us a little bit about his role in the Declaration of Independence.
Sure. Well, as I mentioned before, he's on the Committee of Five that drafted it. He's probably one of the least intimately involved in that because he's doing so much other stuff. We do have some records. We have Jefferson's draft and where some things were changed and added and that sort of thing. But he was certainly intimately involved with that. And then, of course, he would have been involved when Congress discussed and passed that. One thing I think that's just critical to remember is we tend to think, and political theorists do this, they tend to read the Declaration of Independence in light of Thomas Jefferson, and particularly Thomas Jefferson's private beliefs. So you can read in some of Jefferson's private letters that he really is a deist. He's one of the very few Americans that embrace something approximating deism. And so we say, okay, well, when he says nature's God, or providence, he's thinking of the theistic God. And one thing I point out is that this is not what most Americans would have thought when they read those phrases. I give a good example, the Westminster Standards, which are a classic Reformed confession of faith, both in the original 1647 version and the later 1788 American Revision. They refer to the deity as the supreme judge, the creator of all things, the first cause, the righteous judge, God the Creator, the supreme law and king of the world, certainly providence. Isaac Watts, the father of English hymnody, refers to God as nature's God. It might be the case that deists refer to God using phrases like nature's God or providence, but so did other Americans, indisputably Orthodox Americans. And so when Congress, you know, passed this document, Jefferson drafted it, he did a great job, but ultimately, it's a product of the community, and I think it's just an error to read this document in light of that sort of thinking. There's actually one political theorist, I won't mention him, but he says, look, nature's God is simply nature. You know, Jefferson might have believed that, but Roger Sherman, who, of course, voted to approve the Declaration, William Williams, Benjamin Huntington, other Calvinists from Connecticut, there's no way they would have approved that if that's what they thought the phrase meant. When they heard nature's God, they were thinking the God of Abraham,
yeah,
Isaac, Jacob, not some vague deistic deity.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, you know, a strong majority of people at the Continental Congress were, you know, of the Reformed mindset and, you know, heard that term and said, yeah, hey, good job, Tom, that's really great, let's go with that there.
Sure.
Let's fast forward, and I'm going to go through the skip through the Articles of Confederation, which Roger Sherman actually did play a strong role in as well. But let's fast forward up to the Constitution. And the idea here is, you know, the Constitution, that was written by James Madison, and he's hardly a Calvinist. So, you know, isn't that a godless document? What kind of influence could Sherman or his Calvinist brethren have had on this?
Right. Well, that's a great point. And again, kind of as my complaint about the Declaration of Independence, it's just simply inaccurate to think that the Constitution popped out of the head of James Madison. If you read through the debates of the convention, James Madison does get the ball rolling with the Virginia Plan. But basically, what he had envisioned was a very strong national government with a plenary grant of power. It would have been able to do whatever it wanted to do. And the states would have been completely unrepresented. Now, Sherman, we didn't touch on this earlier, but of course Calvinists have a very negative view of human nature. Humans, of course, are created in the image of God, but then they're profoundly corrupted by sin. And one of the things that I think flows naturally from that is you don't want concentrated power. And so Sherman and many of the Reformed folks are very, very suspicious of concentrating too much power at the national level. They wanted a very limited national government, and they wanted the states to be represented as yet another, as a check upon the national government. And so I think Sherman and others resisted Madison mightily, and Madison lost a lot of battles. He would have had basically one branch of government elected by the people, who then would have appointed another one. And, of course, Sherman forced the Connecticut Compromise, one of the few things a well-read person probably doesn't know about Sherman. He and Ellsworth are generally viewed as the authors of the Connecticut Compromise, whereby the House is elected by the people, and the Senate, back in this era, of course, would have been senators would have been appointed by state legislatures, which then gave the state very important say in the national government. Critically, Sherman pushed for a limited grant of powers, Article 1, Section 8, where if you read that, now we don't take it seriously anymore, and we haven't since the 1930s, but if you read through it, what you'll see is Congress actually has a fairly narrow scope of powers, the power to regulate commerce, the power to have a military, the power to have a post office, and this sort of thing, but it doesn't have the sort of powers to do many of the things that it would have, that it is involved with today. In many respects, you can see that the Constitutional Convention is a battle between James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, and James Wilson on one side, and Roger Sherman, William Patterson, Oliver Ellsworth on the other. And ultimately, you get a big compromise, right? Not just Connecticut Compromise, but an entire document is a compromise, which resulted in federalism, which resulted in a limited national government. After the Connecticut Compromise, Madison and Hamilton really started pushing a strong executive. Sherman didn't like that. He thought that was too much concentrated power, so he fought them tooth and nail. He actually lost a lot of those battles, but with the rise of the imperial presidency that we've seen since the 1970s, it's maybe too bad. It might have been a good thing if he had won more of those battles. Madison gets a lot of credit because of the Federalist Papers, but one of the great ironies is a lot of things he praises in the Federalist Papers are things he actually fought in the Constitutional Convention.
Right.
And so really, I think you have to view the Constitution, just like the Declaration, as a product of a community. And Madison was a critical player. If you have to give one person the title Father of the Constitution, it probably would be Madison. But still, we have to recognize there were lots and lots of influences. And in fact, I would say this, if Madison had gotten his way, and Sherman hadn't been there, people representing Sherman's position, the Constitution would have been presented to the states that would have been unratifiable. No one would ratify the Constitution that said the national government will have a plenary grant of power, no limits by law, no representation of states. I think virtually no state, maybe Virginia would have, but otherwise no state would have ratified.
Now, Thomas Jefferson was overseas at the time that the Constitution was being written and debated, but where would Jefferson have fallen in this debate?
I think pretty close to where Madison was. He did see the need for a stronger national government. I think almost everyone did. Sherman certainly saw a need for a stronger national government. Jefferson probably a bit more suspicious of concentrated power at the national level. And certainly one of the things Jefferson wanted, Madison didn't think was necessary, was a Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights, of course, that what we now know as the first 10 amendments to the U.S. Constitution, were aimed at making sure this national government stayed limited, that the national government wouldn't infringe upon our liberties. And so that's one of his main complaints about the Constitution. And, of course, a lot of anti-federalists made the same complaint. And so one of the first things the first federal Congress did was, they started talking about it, put it off, but they got to and eventually passed the first 10 amendments to the U.S. Constitution.
Yeah, I just think that's kind of interesting that Jefferson would fall more in the direction perhaps of Sherman on this debate when it comes to the Bill of Rights and the limiting of national government, even though we might consider those two to be antithetical in their theologies in that regard. Well, what about these first 10 amendments, specifically the First Amendment? And you know, the issue of religion and religious liberty is a big issue, and you deal with this extensively in all your writings. You know, everybody knows the First Amendment was written by Madison. So what Calvinistic influence could there have been there? I mean, did Calvinists oppose this or what?
Yeah, you know, Sherman didn't think a Bill of Rights was necessary. He said, look, the national government is one of enumerated powers. Congress isn't given the power to establish a national church or to restrict the press. So it's just kind of silly to say Congress can't do that. It would be sort of like Congress having a, within the Bill of Rights, a provision that says that Congress can't require dogs to fly in the air. It's just something that can't be done. But nonetheless, Madison ended up having to promise his constituency a Bill of Rights, and so he did push a Bill of Rights. But Sherman was intimately involved in this whole process. A number of states had proposed different rights that they would like to see added to the Constitution. And so when the House finally got serious about this, what they did is they appointed a committee of one person from each state to sift through all these various proposals. Madison was on that committee, but so was Roger Sherman. And as they started sorting through these various proposals, he came up with a list of 17 possible amendments. This is the only handwritten draft of the Bill of Rights that we have, and it's actually in Sherman's hand, not Madison's. Congress then debated, and Madison's involved, but so is Sherman, as you might imagine. After Congress debates this all up, a committee of three is appointed to put these amendments together that the House had agreed to. Sherman's on that committee, but Madison isn't. Eventually, the Senate debated these things, and just like today, a conference committee was put together in order to sort everything out. Madison was on the House three-person committee, but so was Roger Sherman. So he's there on this critical committee. The Senate committee of three senators was headed by Oliver Ellsworth, a good Connecticut Calvinist, and in fact, Sherman is his protege. So he's there at every step of the way. Madison wanted an amendment that would prevent the states from infringing upon rights. That would have been part of the Bill of Rights. He said, in fact, this is the most important proposal I'm making. Congress didn't agree. They just rejected it. In fact, every proposal that Madison made was changed in one way or the other. Some were rejected. Again, my point is, and I'm really not trying to tear down Madison. He's a great American. He did great things. But it simply is an error to think that the Bill of Rights leapt fully formed out of his head. It was a product of the community. People like Roger Sherman, Oliver Ellsworth had an important role to play in that community. Now, I think if you focus on the religion clauses per se, they begin, of course, Congress shall make no law respecting establishment of religion. There's a lot of debate. What does this mean? Mm-hmm. And this is where you get back to that contemporary agenda. Oftentimes, groups like Americans United for Separation of Church and State or the ACLU will say Jefferson and Madison authored the First Amendment. They wanted the strict separation of church and state. Look at Jefferson's letter to the Danbury Baptist, mm-hmm. Madison's detached memorandum. Therefore, we have to interpret the First Amendment in light of their views, their privately held or sometimes publicly expressed views. And I suppose my response would be not necessarily. It's a product of the community. Let's look first at the words and look at what people like Sherman and Ellsworth or others could reasonably be said to mean by these words. And I suppose my take on the First Amendment then is that it means largely what it says. Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion. Congress can't establish a national church in the same way that Congregational Church was established in Massachusetts or Connecticut, or the Church of England is established to this day in England. But it certainly says nothing to do, it has nothing to do with the extent to which Congress can fund faith-based social service agencies, or presidents can issue calls for prayer and fasting, things like this. Congress simply can't create a national church, what the word says.
Mm-hmm. Let me kind of wrap this up with and connect it back to what we were talking about last week and in the few minutes that we have remaining here, and deal with this issue of whether or not the U.S. was founded as a Christian nation. Now, we've talked a lot here, and I think you've made a very strong case that Reformed theology via Roger Sherman and many others was ever present at the founding, at the drafting of our foundational documents. But does that mean we're founded as a Christian nation? What does that mean? And what's your take on that question of whether or not we were founded as a Christian nation?
Yeah, that's a great question. I understand you're going to have John Fee on your show that asked that question. I've given a talk like that, very similar, Did America Have a Christian Founding? And what both he and I do, and I think this is critical, is you really have to take the question apart and ask, in my case, I say, what would we mean by a Christian founding? What would a founding Christian look like? And then I think we need to determine what exactly we mean by the founding. What I suggest is this. I think that you can make a very good argument that Christianity had a profound and important influence on the American founders. And I delineate a variety of ways in which I think that's the case, and we've alluded to some of those before. And I think you can show very, very important ways in which Christian ideas underlay the war for independence and the resistance to Great Britain, and then later the creation of a constitutional republic as well. I believe that Christian ideas underlie our approach to religious liberty. And one of the things that's crystal clear is very orthodox folks like Roger Sherman are crystal clear that we need to tolerate and accept people that are different from us, not because of some postmodernism, everyone's ideas are equally valid, but because people should be free to work these things out for themselves. So as a relatively young man, when he published his almanacs, he included things like list of when the Quaker meetings would be, the Anglican observable days, things of this. Some of his Calvinist friends complained. They said, why are you doing this? Don't you know these are papist-like ceremonies? And basically Sherman said, look, I'm free to observe these or not, and they're free as well, but it certainly is reasonable for me to list these in my almanac. George Washington, of course, famously wrote to the Hebrew congregation in Newport, Rhode Island, where he says, a Jewish congregation there, where he says basically, look, America is intended to be a country for anyone of any belief or even non-belief, as long as these people are willing to take up the responsibilities of citizenship. And I think those ideas are profoundly influenced by Christian ideas. They're not influenced, or not very much. I think they're in alignment with Enlightenment ideas, but I think those Enlightenment ideas had relatively little influence in the era. So, again, was it intended to be a uniquely Christian nation, a nation only for Christians? Clearly not. Were Christian ideas very influential in the American founding? Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that is a really excellent way to put it, because I think the debate sometimes gets so simplified that when we say, well, we're a Christian nation, people immediately jump to the idea, well, that means it's a theocracy, and as you said, only for Christians and such. But you make a great case, you know, through the words and through the deeds of Roger Sherman, that, this is a place for all, and that those ideas were embedded in this Reform theology. And I guess that brings me to the question, the last question we have for you, which is the so what question. I mean, this is stuff that happened 230 years ago. You know, so what, right? What does this debate over the United States being founded as a Christian nation or having these foundational Christian ideals embedded in its in the founding process, why is that relevant for today?
That's a great question. I think, first of all, we just want to have an accurate understanding of our nation's history, right? Just as any nation would want to have an accurate understanding of their history. And I think if we pretend religion and specifically Calvinism wasn't important in our nation's history and even into the founding era, I think we miss a very important piece of our history. The U.S. Supreme Court has made it crystal clear that the founders' views are very relevant for understanding the First Amendment. Many Supreme Court decisions rely upon the views of Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, which they used to shine light on the meaning of the religion clauses, usually to defend a strict separation of church and state. So one of the things I've done in some of my work is I say, look, if we say the founders' views are meaningful here, and we look at the broader range of founders that were involved in writing and ratifying the First Amendment, we find this is not at all what they want. They're not against issuing calls for prayer and fasting. They're not against funding faith-based social service agencies. They don't think that we have to remove under God, or they wouldn't have thought we need to remove under God from the Pledge of Allegiance. Now, some of these things might be prudential. It might be prudential not to fund faith-based social service agencies, but constitutionally it's not a requirement. So I think it matters for that. And then I think in public discourse it matters as well. Politicians are routinely appealing to the founders and the founders' views, particularly on these sorts of questions. And so I think it's important that we have, if we're going to say the founders' views matter, we should have an accurate understanding of what the founders wanted. Now, if we want to say that founders' views don't matter, then I suppose it might not be quite as important, except as a matter of historical interest. But the way Americans act, particularly Americans involved in legal and political discourse, they act as if the founders' views matter. So it seems to me we ought to get those views right.
Well, I think that's a really good point to close on here. I just want to wish that you have a great and safe trip to China. Actually, when you go to China, I don't know if you know this, but you can stay in touch with Research on Religion on Facebook and our Facebook page. And that's true of every one of our listeners out there. If you want to go ahead to our website and click on our Facebook page, we can make sure that you're constantly updated to let you know what is going on here on the show and when Mark David Hall is going to be joining us once again. So, Mark, I want to thank you very much for being on the show today.
Thank you for having me, Tony. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.